content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading selections from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the May issue of Our State magazine, the theme of which features articles all about a mountain spring break. So we're headed to higher elevations, so roll down your windows and let the fresh mountain air take care of the rest. With our next article, we'll continue our tour of Cold Mountain. This article is entitled Haywood Handmade. An art collective in Canton brings together a community of veteran craftspeople and welcomes new ones into the fold. Hannah Berniski runs her scoring tool along the edges of a clay slab, demonstrating for a new student at Cold Mountain Art Collective. She coaxes the clay into a cylinder, then pinches it into the shape of a four-leaf clover. "Slowly encourage the clay," she says. "Clay doesn't like to be forced. You have to ask it very nicely." The student mirrors Berniski's movements to form the legs of a critter. It's meant to be a Highland cow, complete with ceramic horns, a snout, and crown fluff, but when it takes on non-bovine features, Berniski is reassuring. "He's supposed to be animated," she says with a smile. One of the most popular experiences at Cold Mountain Art Collective is the critter class, designed for all skill levels. Llamas, cats, flying pigs, and any other creature of their choosing. On the shelves above Berniski's wheels, afternoon light catches on the unglazed ceramics that were born there. There are bowls and mugs from locals and visitors who tried their hand at throwing during one of the studio's workshops. There are gallery-quality pieces from traveling artists who made a pit stop in Canton. And there's plenty of Berniski's signature wood grain serveware, inspired by the hours she spent playing in the Pigeon River with her partner and two sons. "A lot of the sticks and stones that I use in some of my work comes from there," she says. "It's just the most peaceful place." Berniski opened Cold Mountain Art Collective for anyone interested in art, making it, learning it, or buying it. This is the kind of place that she imagined as a young potter working in a brick shed that faced Cold Mountain. And before that, when she took her first pottery class 15 years ago, after graduating from high school in her native Fairview, Berniski went to college to become an English teacher, but she found herself uninspired. A friend's mom had taken a ceramics course, and Berniski was amazed at what she'd created. So she enrolled nearby at AB Tech, but after the first 6 weeks, she couldn't center clay on the wheel. Berniski wasn't fazed. She knew pottery was meant for her, and she for it. She retook the class, and it finally clicked. She bought a wheel and moved it from apartment to apartment and eventually to her stone house in Canton, where she built a family, a business, and a community of artists seeking space to create, sell, and grow. Opened in the town's old ice cream parlor in 2021, Cold Mountain Art Collective serves all of those needs. Climbing up along a doorframe or brass flood markers from four major storms, the building has survived. Fred, Francis, Ivan, and at the top, Helene. Subtle reminders of the strength of this mountain community and its makers. A few other collective artists have led classes in the studio space, and Berniski often joins visitors as a student herself. She's taken classes with artists like Jason Pearson, who demonstrated fabric dyeing using rust and food scraps, and Heidi Brickhouse, who helped beginners weave a pair of fringe earrings in an introduction to beadwork. With educational offerings that range from a 5-week wheel course to afternoon hand-building classes, Berniski is fulfilling a personal need she thought she'd given up on as well. "I guess I've always been kind of destined to teach something," she says, looking around the studio at the hand-thrown bowls and animated critters that were created there. Each one carries the personality of an artist, novice or experienced, who wandered in to learn. And the Cold Mountain Art Collective is located at 33 Adams Street in Canton, North Carolina. And they have a website, coldmountainartcollective.com. That's coldmountainartcollective.com. Our next article in the series of A Perfect Weekend in Cold Mountain Country is entitled Swing for the Hills. For decades, golfers from around the Southeast have flocked to a family-owned resort in Crusoe for a tee time with a view. Just a few minutes before you reach Springdale Resort, you'll pass a sign across from the Pigeon River that says, Welcome to Crusoe, 9 miles of friendly people, plus one old crab. Depending on the day, that old crab might be found at the resort number 13, on number 13, affectionately known as the Springdale Spasm. This uphill par 4 challenges players to clear a narrow fairway and approach a green wedged between a creek and an out-of-bounds area. But players aren't crabby for long. Once they clear 13, they're rewarded with a view of Cold Mountain that, for a moment, can make any player forget about their scorecard. General Manager Jeremy Boone loves that view. Even when he's not out on the course, he admires a photograph hanging on his office wall of a sunset casting a purple glow over the course of the iconic peak. While he's only been general manager for a year and a half, after spending 5 years as Springdale's superintendent, he's been drawn to that view since he was a child. In the 1970s, when Boone was a boy, his father built homes around the new golf course while his mother ran the food and beverage operation at the resort. She hemmed the pros' pants, as well as cooked and cleaned, and did whatever else had to be done, Boone said. She also employed Boone's grandmother to help feed all the hungry golfers. Back then, they did home-style or family-style cooking, Boone says. They had lazy Susans on the table, and they fixed big bowls of beans, potatoes, and corn. Golf first came to this property in 1968 as a 9-hole course. The local Tingle family bought the course and expanded it to 18 holes. To promote the sport in western North Carolina, family patriarch Fred Tingle helped form the Great Smoky Mountain Golf Association in the 1980s. Many of the courses were too small to afford their own marketing, so Tingle banded together his competitors to purchase ads in national golf publications to put the region on the map. This brought players to Springdale from all over the Southeast, and many returned year after year. Today, Boone recognizes plenty of faces while out on the grounds. Some are new friends, like players from the Asheville Tourists who stop by between home games. A few longtime Springdale golfers tell Boone stories of his mother's cooking and sewing and how they once held him as he was a baby. The long-timers ask about Claude Trull, the cart boy who started at Springdale when he was 16. Boone tells them he's around here somewhere and that he just celebrated his 72nd birthday. In 2018, the Tingles sold Springdale to the West family, who had spent years visiting the area to enjoy the rolling golf courses. In 2022, the Wests unveiled a new Stone Lodge-style clubhouse where golfers and their families enjoy Appalachian cuisine with Smoky Mountain views at the Rocky Face Tavern. Across from the hostess stand hangs an illustrated map of this area when it was the new college, a working farm school for prospective teachers at Columbia University who traveled from New York to this rural community in the early 20th century. Details like this and the people who've been here for decades tie Springdale's legacy of service and deep-rooted history to its new luxury amenities and modern accommodations. For people like Boone, Springdale's history is his history. Every day on his way to work, Boone drives past his home place just a half mile before the Crusoe sign. Standing at the first hole's tee and looking toward the resort entrance, he can see his grandparents' headstones at Crusoe United Methodist Church across the way. When his two sons were in high school, they became the fourth generation of Boones to work at Springdale. Who knows? Maybe we'll have another generation years from now, Boone says. For now, he and the rest of the Springdale team are caring for its present and past as a golfer's great Smoky Mountain getaway. For more information about Springdale Resort, You can find them at 200 Golf Watch Road in Canton, North Carolina. And they have a website, springdaleresortnc.com. That's springdaleresortnc.com. Our next stop in Cold Mountain is Strawberry Fields Forever. Every weekend from spring through fall, a farm in Canton throws a pizza party to showcase the freshest picks of the year. Tires rumble beneath eager children and their patient parents on a hayride through the 10-acre garden. The tractor chugs between rows of crops among the Haywood County peaks, then slows to a stop behind a half acre of asparagus in a chicken coop. The children, still obediently planted on red gingham blanket, crane their heads toward the flock and point out their favorites. An entranced baby on her mom's lap, her lilac dress as bright as the nearby dahlias, points and squeals, "Buck, buck!" Mark Davies hops off the tractor and points to the chickens, naming them as he tells the group how they provide his family and the farm with about 50 eggs a day. The tour winds along the west fork of the Pigeon River and a sea of strawberries. Come April and May, visitors can take a short hay wagon trip to the 16,000 berry plants where they can pick their own mountain souvenirs, one of the farm's best sellers in the spring. Mark brings the wagon to a stop in front of the 10 acres farm stand, and passengers begin to climb down. One of them, Mark's wife, Morgan Wynorski Davies, calls after the children who were sitting by her just a moment ago and are now bounding down the dirt path toward the picnic tables. As the kids chase each other between families enjoying homemade pizza, local musician Hope Griffin strums a guitar on a small stage, serenading the growing children and crops with gentle renditions of Fleetwood Mac's Landslide and other classics. Cynthia Goff, co-owner of the farm, rounds up her free-range grandchildren, while her son-in-law Mark readies the old Massey Ferguson tractor for the next tour, and her daughter Morgan welcomes visiting families. In the back of the building, a retired early education teacher tosses pizza dough over her knuckles before laying seasonal produce atop the crust. She loads the pie into the brick oven, then turns to the next order. Every Saturday night from April through October, the 10-acre garden offers homemade pizzas crowned with the fruits or veggies of the farm's labor, along with live music and hay rides. The toppings change with the season. Spring breakers can choose from combinations like asparagus and microgreens with a ricotta lemon base or strawberry balsamic reduction drizzled over goat cheese. The Davises spent 10 years living abroad in Europe and Asia, where Morgan worked as a school librarian and Mark prepared taxes. During the COVID pandemic, the family found themselves unable to leave their high-rise apartment in Hong Kong. Mark began to research homesteading, and the family decided to return to the U.S. and settle on some land. While in Haywood County for a family reunion, they visited 10 Acre one Saturday for some pizza. As their three young children explored the property, the couple spoke to then-owner Danny Barrett, who was keen on finding the right family to carry on his century farm. "We saw the potential," Morgan says. "We wanted to continue Danny's vision and help it grow." Today, it's the Davises who serve pizzas to families while their three young'uns, the interns as they call them, play amid the produce and flowers the family has tended. "I love to see the kids getting dirty and the parents being able to relax," Morgan says. Through homemade pizzas, hay rides, berry and flower picking, and farm gatherings, she and Mark are sharing a taste of the life they once dreamed of in a place they're delighted to call home. The 10-acre garden is located at 148 Chambers Farm Lane in Canton, North Carolina, and the website is the10acregarden.com. The10acregarden.com. And the word 10 is spelled out, T-E-N, of course. Next we have, in the series about Cold Mountain, it's From the Ground Up. A restaurant in Waynesville pays homage to the hard work that built a family's legacy. This is about Singletree Heritage Kitchen. At Singletree Heritage Kitchen, McRae Davis and Josh Weeks honor the handmade. A metal tree sculpture by artist Grace Cathy stands outside while Chef Weeks' dishes rest on tables that the couple made from wormy chestnut Barnwood. And the picture here looks like there's some scallops, and that there's a steak with some macaroni and cheese, artfully done. It's very appealing to the eyes. There's a piece of salmon fillet. There's some soup, some rustic crostini, and a little charcuterie board with cheeses and meats, and some sweet items, some chutneys and such, and pickles. At this Waynesville restaurant, Singletree Heritage Kitchen, founder and head chef Josh Weeks puts in the work. Take his steak dinner. Weeks char-grills a peppered prime New York strip to order and serves it over whipped North Carolina sweet potatoes alongside local French beans, smoked tomato-infused butter, and a house steak sauce. The sauce alone takes 4 days to make. Weeks starts by creating a bone stock, which is cooked down into a demi-glace and further processed into a cuisson, infused with stone fruits, fresh herbs, and a red wine from Singletree's meticulously curated selection. We go the hard route every time, Weeks says with a laugh, but it works. We really care about the end result and the quality. We care so much about the experience people are going to have. The work doesn't stop there. If you're enjoying supper at the bar, the single slab of black walnut beneath your plate was also harvested, crafted, and installed by Weeks and his wife, Singletree co-owner McRae Davis. If you're in the dining room, the wormy chestnut table you're seated at is also a Weeks original, made from local reclaimed barnwood. Oh, and the dining room itself, with its large windows overlooking Singletree's gardens and the Smoky Mountains peak beyond, was designed by Weeks, who spent more than 30 years training, cooking, and dreaming of this restaurant. Weeks has long been smitten with Western North Carolina. As a child growing up in the farming family in Fayetteville, he often visited the mountains for hiking trips in the summer and skiing getaways in the winter. Back home, Weeks loved spending time in his mother's and grandmother's kitchens, where he'd watch them make everything from scratch. He'd help pick and preserve muscadines and harvest and bake cherries for a warm fruit pudding, now a dessert staple at Singletree. In her later years, his paternal grandmother traveled around the world and brought culinary techniques and recipes back to her grandson. She was flambéing shrimp and making all these soufflés and beautiful food that I'd never seen before, Weeks says. These three women are the reason I cook. They all cooked and hosted in their own different ways, and I felt like that's what I should do. While driving through Waynesville one day, he and Davis passed by Walker Service, the almost century-old auto shop in the middle of town, and noticed a dumpster sitting out front. The Cathay family had owned the shop since the 1920s. The third generation to run it, Clayton Cathay and his wife Grace, a local artist, had sectioned off part of the space for a gallery to display Grace's metal sculptures, some of which featured old car parts from the station. The couple were looking to retire and sold the property to relatives who were preparing the building to be rented. Davis took in the station from their road and said something that would change their lives forever. That would make a really cool restaurant. Today, the old service station catches everyone's eye. The restaurant is surrounded by handmade garden beds filled with native plants, many of which were propagated by Davis, a horticulturist. In 2023, she left her job as head gardener at the Swag Hotel to join Weeks full-time at Singletree, where she runs the front of the house and can often be found behind the bar, mixing cocktails and chatting with visitors. She's really the culture builder here, Weeks says. She's the one who makes everybody happy. Standing over the goldenrod, echinacea, and foxglove beside the parking lot, the branches of a metal tree reach up toward the spring sky. The Grace Cathay original stood in this very spot when Haywood County motorists still came here to get their oil changed. Now, whenever the Cathays come in for dinner, they're reminded of their family's legacy in this place. Weeks keeps a few of Grace's sculptures inside the restaurant, too, in addition to work from other local artists and some of his antiques. His proudest piece hangs over the bar, a Singletree, or metal bar, that was once used to balance the pull of a plow in the days when horses and mules drew them. When Weeks looks at the Singletree, he is reminded of the hard work his family sowed into their eastern North Carolina soil for generations. After Weeks and Davis settle on the restaurant's name, Week's mother, Mackie, gifted him the single tree her father and grandfather used to plow their fields. Mackie and her husband, Mayan, were known in Fayetteville for their dedication to local arts and culture and for always welcoming neighbors and friends into their home. For 2 years after Single Tree opened, Mackie made the restaurant's muscadine jelly from scratch until she was no longer able. She died in January 2025, but her spirit of hospitality lives on. "She's always been my biggest fan," Weeks says. "She's a lot of the reason why all of this has worked out." Weeks and Davis plan to rehang the single tree over the patio to welcome everyone to the restaurant built on hard work, where North Carolina food and farming are celebrated and where family legacies live on. Single Tree Heritage Kitchen is located at 136 Depot Street, number 101, Waynesville, North Carolina, and their website is singletreekitchen.com. The next article is entitled "The Gentle Border." Split rail fences don't shout, "Keep out." They lean, they shift, they invite. And in western North Carolina, they remind us that some lines are meant to hold, not harden. At sunrise along the Blue Ridge Parkway, a split rail fence follows the curve of the land, a simple boundary that has defined Appalachian pastures and paths for generations. And the photograph is of that split rail fence with a bevy of wildflowers on the left side and on the right side, and a beautiful sunrise, the sun breaking over the clouds and showing the peaks of the mountains in the background, with a beautiful color, sort of golden colors in the photo. If you grew up a little wild and a little rural, you may have learned the magic of a loose fence post early on. A post with some give meant you could slip from one world into another with relative ease. All it took was one lowered shoulder to nudge the shaky post a little to the side so that horizontal rail slid from its place, then a swift Jenga maneuver, and the resulting opening would be big enough for a small, mildly wide, and rural child to crawl through. On the other side, you'd slot the rail right at the post and carry on your way, no one the wiser. Of course, there were other types of barriers to a young rambler's life: wire, picket, chain link, and the dreaded electric. Each fence required a new kind of elusiveness, and those newer models became more prominent year after year as old fences were replaced by more obstructive methods. But I love the split rail fence the most, and not only for its laxity. I respected the cleanness of the pyramidal rails sliding into and out of their respective places. No nails or screws or wires required. Everything had been arranged just so. And just so was enough to keep cows in their place, even if I'd found some loopholes. No matter the advances in boundary keeping, split rail fences still take up a lot of real estate in western North Carolina. They run along the Blue Ridge Parkway and through state and national forests. They hold their ground on time-capsuled farms in places like Cataloochee and Cherokee and Burnsville. But it's not only in these preserved, protected spaces. Old-fashioned fences work to hold livestock and divide plots on any number of properties across the mountains today, leaning a little, maybe, but doing the job nonetheless. If you listen, a split-rail fence can tell stories about the people and places we come from. Early European settlers preferred chestnut for their fences because it split cleanly and it resisted rot. It's been more than a century since the blight arrived to kill off all the American chestnuts, but some of the rails split from those disappeared trees still line pastures and fields, reminding us of a landscape now forever gone. Supporters of Abraham Lincoln often showed up to campaign events carrying rails he was said to have split. Back then, he was called the rail splitter, and some pennies today depict Lincoln sitting on a log, the tools of the trade at his side. A maul and wedges. T.C. and I laid fence worm. My great-great-great-great-grandfather wrote in his diaries in May of 1812. After a little head-scratching, I realized fence worm referred to the zigzag style built in the first days of America. This fence, sometimes called a worm or snake, is all rail. No posts, no digging. The split rails are laid in overlapping pattern, meeting at the corners before zagging in another direction, using only gravity and balance to keep it out or hold in. The worm fence and its cousin, the buck fence, picture haystack desserts, rails leaning and tangled into a series of X's, were semi-transient. Anyone could pick up the timber and relocate a fence when needed. Nothing was affixed or buried or permanent. During the Civil War, many soldiers did just that, repurposing worm fences to use as cover or to build fires. I know some people will say the split rail fence is a quaint thing of the past, a relic of bygone era. Sure, newer fences may be sturdier and more restrictive, but what's a fence for exactly? Does it aim to forever separate one place from another, laying claim to land as if we have that kind of power? Or is it something more temporary, more of a suggestion than a command? I'd ask to know. What was I walling in or walling out? The speaker of Robert Frost's famous poem, Mending Wall, wonders. And it's a good question. Before the passing of various fence laws in the 19th century, many mountain people relied on open grazing. As the story goes, the notorious Hatfield-McCoy feud was started in part because of a dispute over a stray hog. Maybe a good fence would have made better neighbors there. And before European settlers started splitting and stacking rails, most indigenous groups farmed without fences and shared hunting grounds. Fences brought some sharp, dangerous divisions. I'm not saying I'm anti-fence. My neighbor's calves recently pushed through the wood fence to bounce around my yard and entertain my dogs. So I do appreciate the need for some separation, but I prefer the impermanence and permeability of a split rail fence to other options. A split rail fence says, slow down, not go away. It doesn't claim to be a forever border, only something that had once been a tree and is now reshaped to do another job. Its rails boast their imperfections, eschewing uniformity, and its arrangement exposes its vulnerabilities. It could be dismantled or moved on a whim. It could be nudged and briefly undone for a young boy to pass through. It's solid but provisional, here for now, but maybe gone tomorrow. And that's a lesson for all of us to keep learning. There's a beautiful picture here of a road and a fence and going into the sunset. It says Thunder Hill Overlook along the Blue Ridge Parkway boasts a simple fence running the ridge, a reminder that some borders guide more than they divide. A split rail fence frames Bluff Mountain in Doughton Park, where rails like these, once cut by hand from mountain timber, helped earn one young frontiersman the nickname, the Rail Splitter. Well, that sound means that we're out of time for this episode of Our State Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-582-315138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.